What happens when someone convinces an Olympic gymnast that he can act? Something like Gymkata. American gymnast Kurt Thomas stars as American gymnast Jonathan Cabot. What range? Who is recruited by the CIA to, wait for it, become a spy for the U.S. government. Ah, but not just any spy, a spy who uses martial arts. And not just any spy who uses martial arts, but a spy who uses martial arts infused with moves learned from gymnastics. Welcome back to Cinecast. With Sam Hallgren, I'm Adam Kempinar. We have reached the final segment of our special deluxe edition 100th episode. And briefly there, we played a clip from one
Matt
of our
Singer.
Our favorite top fives. They're so bad, they're good. And Matt Singer's great email about Gymkata, the wonders of Gymkata. And yes, we just couldn't help but laugh as we read that entire plot description. Gymkata is a classic. I'll definitely give Matt that. And also, we had Scott Ferguson right there, his top five male modern. No big surprises there. I can't argue with his list.
No, I can't either. But I think something he mentioned, whether it's an email or something, and he said, like, you don't notice. I mean, these are, yes, contemporary post-studio system performances, but, I mean, none more recent than 20 years ago or
correct,
25 years ago. And he says, you know, I think maybe performances need 20 years or so to enter the pantheon. I don't know if that'll be the case in our lists.
Maybe not.
But it's
then
a good
again,
point.
It might be.
Oh, well,
we'll just have to wait and see as we get to the male dramatic. So we are back to our countdown, starting with female dramatic. Dylan Kidd, get it started.
I don't know I think it's a sign of the times that when I was going through this, more of the actresses ended up being from classic cinema, which tells you that maybe like female roles are sort of suffering in the last 20 years or so. So let's see, my number five, any number of Bergman women could have ended up in this list. Number five, I chose Harriet Anderson in Summer with Monica, which is like just a great, like sexy, Bergman actually talks about it, and he has a book where he talks about his movies, and he talks about how Harriet Anderson in this movie sort of like literally moved film acting forward, and I think he's right. And it also is just like total eye candy. I mean, she's just the sexiest woman ever, and it's just a great, you know, there's a real filmic tradition, I think, of performances involving women who are sort of stuck in small towns, like sort of people like birds trapped in cages, and this is like the ultimate one. And she's just great. And there's a moment near the end of the film where she looks into the camera, which apparently was not planned at all, which is just like blows your mind. So number five, Harriet Anderson in Summer with Monica.
Harriet Anderson from Ingmar Bergman. You could pick like Liv Ullmann. You could pick a number of Bergman women, and certainly Harriet Anderson is a great choice. My number five, Sam, you had her on your comedic list. I've got her on my dramatic list, Emma Thompson for Remains of the Day as Miss Kenton. There's just something so fun about watching the dance she and Anthony Hopkins have to do, and it's heartbreaking that they never connect, and yet something so exciting about watching them try to connect. I think she's a brilliant actress and brilliant in that role.
I totally agree. My number five, Kidman is all over this list. I've got her actually in Dogville. I actually had to choose. I think Kidman belongs here. Nicole Kidman belongs on this list somewhere, and I thought of the performance of hers that really made the biggest impact on me. I can't quite call Dogville a pleasurable experience, Lars von Trier's film, but it's certainly an incredible performance. And I feel like Nicole Kidman, he talks about beautiful people being beautiful on screen. Yes, I think Kidman, it's fair to say, yes, she is a beautiful, beautiful woman, but she also definitely has the chops, and you don't see it anywhere. If you see it in a number of places, but you also absolutely see it here in Dogville.
Okay, good case there made for Nicole Kidman, Sam. We get to number four, Dylan Kidd.
Emmanuel Davos in My Sex Life or How I Got Into an Argument, which is this French film by Arnaud Desplechin, which I just think is incredible. He directed Kings and Queen, but My Sex Life to me is the best, one of the best films ever made, and she's kind of the emotional heart of it. It's a movie about, you know, people who kind of think and talk more than feel, and she ends up having to be the sort of heart of this very brainy movie, and it's just an amazing. I mean, she's a great actress anyway, but and also one of those interesting people who you hear people talk about like Pretty Ugly a lot. She's one of those people you literally don't know if she's gorgeous or homeless. She's just an amazing face. So I think so much of the cinema is just about someone's face. And it's like, you know, as big a movie as like The New World is, it's really just about that woman's face.
Emmanuel Davos in My Sex Life, not a film I've seen.
No, not familiar with, and I've tried to look it up. It's not even one that's easy to get. I don't believe Netflix has it. It may not.
I don't think
he made it up.
He made it up
out of his consciousness. He may.
It's a film he hopes to make someday.
Yeah, it could be. Well, my number four, Sam, is the choice that's going to infuriate you.
Oh, no.
But I didn't do it just to make you mad. It's a legitimate choice.
Network or Chinatown? What is it?
Faye Dunaway in network. I think she's just absolutely a force of nature in this film, and someone who is so smart and able to cut through the BS that you get sucked into her really cynical, jaded worldview. And you can see why, I think, William Holden would actually fall for her, even though she stands for everything he's completely against. I think that is what makes Faye Dunaway so wonderful, that sensuality, that intelligence. Yeah. She's a good actress.
I'd like to cut through the BS as well and call her a bad actress.
I know you
actually
would.
The worst actress, the most overrated actress of all time.
I can't believe you're doing that to me.
On our 100th episode.
On our 100th episode on this list.
Undermining your
I'd
top
expect
five
nothing
list.
Less from you, Sam.
Maybe I'll give you a chance later on in here to undermine one of my picks. My number four, a contemporary actress of mine, Hope Davis, as Dana Hurst in Secret Lives of Dentists, a film I absolutely love, and I think this is maybe her best so far to date, her best screen performance. And it's just her honesty and intelligence of the performance. And it's to me, her performances are always a little breathtaking. And yes, this film is very heavy about a marriage breaking apart, but she, you know, she makes that experience pleasurable in her dedication to a character.
Okay, and number three here then from Dylan Kidd.
Number three, Deborah Winger in terms of endearment. I got to do it. This was a movie that I sort of hated for the content. I saw it when I was 12, so I was like the kid that was snickering when everyone else was crying. I thought I just hated this movie. But I remember just being really struck by how natural her performance is. There's some scene where she's with Jeff Daniels, and he says something, and she's like, oh, my nipples just got hard. I remember just being like blown away that somebody could like say that on film. And I think like, and she deserves a place on this list just because she's the ultimate example of somebody who was just born in the wrong era. A great actress in a time where just there are no roles for women. Her and Jessica Lange just like spent the 80s reading one crappy script after another. And this is the one time she really got to shine.
I love the fact that he can throw in Deborah Winger in there for a movie that, as guys, we kind of laugh at because it's so sappy and kind of a chick flick. But he makes a great case about her and Jessica Lange maybe being born in the wrong era.
Absolutely.
Great actresses, no great roles. I think that's why I had such a hard time with my female list to some extent.
Yeah.
My number three, though, I did go back a ways for my number three. She was on my top five actresses list, and it's Monica Vitti, the Italian actress, in her Alienation trilogy with Antonioni. You've got La Ventura, La Notte, and Le Eclisse. There is something about the longing she exhibits. She's someone who is just searching for something, and she doesn't know what it is, and you don't know what it is, but she's so amazing to watch that I would watch her eat soup.
Yep, no, that's a great point about a great actress. I mean, there's something just about their presence. I think this was number one on my favorite actresses list. It's Cate Blanchett. And I'm safe for her performance in Heaven. I almost, looking back at the list, I knew she belonged on here because I'm genuinely awestruck by every performance she gives. But in Heaven, I think, it was an overlooked DVD pick of mine, maybe a month and a half ago. It's a film I love. She's incredible in it. Giovanni Ribisi is also very good in it. But also her performance, and this may be one of my single greatest performances, is her performance as both herself and her cousin in Coffee and Cigarettes. It is just an amazing achievement where really it's just her playing two characters speaking to each other, and there is no, you don't have any sense that it isn't taking place live right in front of your eyes. It's just a remarkable thing to see, and it's worth seeing Coffee and Cigarettes, which is largely a mitza kind of film, but certainly worth seeing for that. But there's something, she's almost like this impeccably tuned instrument.
Yeah.
She's so, every gesture is just such a reflection of the character she's embodying.
Incredible. It was hard to leave her off the list for me. And we go now to Dylan's number two.
Number two is Dita Parlow in La Dalante. This was the first film that I was shown at film school. I've never seen this actress in anything else, but she is she's just totally magical. And there are a couple of moments in this film where she, I think this, to me, there's something really exciting about watching an old black and white movie and seeing somebody do something very like kind of spontaneous, where it feels like more like a Cassavetes film or something. And she has a bunch of moments in this movie where it's like this very, you know, gorgeous, you know, mid-30s French film photographed by Boris Kaufman, like magical realism. And yet she, it's like, you know, it's like she wandered in off a Henry Jaglom set or something. And I don't know. This was a film that really, like, I mean, part of it was that it was my first day at film school, but this was a very special film for me.
I love his point he makes there about you're watching a film that's so old, and yet she seems like it's that she came in from a Cassavetes film or a Jaglom film or something like that. That's a great point. And it's true. She almost jumps off the screen because she comes in wearing this white dress. She just got married, and she comes into this film. She's the only woman you see in the movie for like the first 15 minutes. So, of course, she's going to stand out and really kind of have that presence. She is really good in that film, though. Sam, your number two.
My number two, I can't imagine this isn't, I hope I'm not stealing thunder here for you, because it's a performance we both love, and it's Naomi Watts as Betty Elms, Diane Selwyn in Mulholland Drive. And Naomi Watts has this sort of messy emotional commitment to her characters that is just fascinating to watch. I remember reading one review of Naomi Watts' performance, and I think it was of 21 Grams, and it's like some actresses, and maybe particularly Naomi Watts, they're more fascinating somehow when they're just breaking down into tears.
Yeah.
And there's something about that. And yet there are moments in Mulholland Drive where there's these amazing moments of clarity of character.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think of that one scene, which is, again, I've talked about Cate Blanchett's performance in Coffee and Cigarettes. Second maybe to that is Naomi Watts' performance when she's auditioning for that role,
mm-hmm,
in Mulholland Drive. It is just a transformative moment,
yeah,
in film. You can't believe it's been captured on cinema.
No, it's that
and,
good.
And it's that good, and she's that good, and I don't know if she's been given a part quite worthy of her since then. She's been very good. She was great in 21 Grams, for example,
yeah,
but Mulholland Drive will be on her tombstone.
Well, we overlap now directly, Sam. My number two, Naomi Watts in Mulholland Drive. There is an amazing emotional availability that Naomi Watts shows, and I think if you go back and watch that role, you mentioned with Cate Blanchett playing two roles, she plays two roles in this film and is amazing in differentiating the characters and in a very subtle way. It's a very daring performance. She's a daring actress, and it's really this kind of bravura acting. It calls some attention to itself, and yet it's subtle, too. It never feels like she's giving a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's my number two. I love her as well. Let's get to the number one, and Dylan's choice may sound a little familiar.
And the number one, and again, all these are like kind of blurring the example, because this is also a great comedic performance, but Giulietta Messina, Knights of Cabiria, again, an obvious one, but there's something interesting about film where you're actually able to photograph somebody's soul or their life force, and whatever it is about this woman, her life force is somehow on display in this movie in a really special way. And a lot of stuff that could be, as great as Fellini is, sometimes he falls into sort of like a sentimentality or whatever, and she just somehow transcends it all. And to me, it's a staggering, like, you know, this may be my favorite performance of all time, regardless of gender and genre.
Certainly, my point that I brought up when you chose to put her on your top as your top performance in comedic,
uh-huh,
in a comedic role, and I was like, my God, I just saw this film. This is a kind of tragic film, and I think. But Dylan mentions that too.
That it goes both ways,
it really
because
does.
He remembers it probably just like I do. He remembers the vitality, and what he says is so great about her life force being on display, and it's somehow true. She really does. Somehow you get to the soul of it. I love that he says it might be his favorite performance ever.
Yeah.
Because it's right up there with me, too, as well. And then that gets to my number one, Sam. No big shock here. I've talked about this movie quite a bit in different top fives, and it is Meryl Streep in Sophie's Choice. She won the Best Actress Oscar for it. Of course, as everyone points out, the Polish accent's perfect, but really no performance and no film maybe wrecks me more than this one.
Yeah.
She's just absolutely devastating. And Alan Pakula, he knows when to leave well enough alone and to just put the camera on Meryl Streep and let her talk to the camera and tell her story with her eyes focused right on you. She's so full of life, Sophie is in that movie, and yet life just will not let her live, basically. She just wants to experience life, and she can't, and it's tragic, and she's brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great pick. I'm actually going to echo one of Scott Ferguson's picks. I alluded to it. Jane Fonda in Clued is my number one.
Number one.
Performance. It really is because, I mean, it's a fantastic performance, but we were talking about Naomi Watts, for example, who is makes herself emotionally available and maybe has this sort of messy emotional commitment. But I think there's a difference between that and the rawness with which Jane Fonda performs, you know, gives a truly raw performance in Clued, and yet it's never indulgent. You just feel like she's just embraced every negative, raw, naked quality to this performance of Brie in Clued, and it's just the film is just there's a great performance. It's a great film anyway, but that performance is literally, you know, just kind of legendary and iconic.
Okay, honorable mentions for Dylan Kidd, here they are.
There are a couple of performances that, like, when I was thinking of male comedic performances, I was like, well, Michael Lerner and Barton Fink is one of my all-time favorite performances ever, but that's really a supporting thing. So I wanted to make a separate category for people that, like, were you know, smaller parts of movies. And there's an actress named Gwen Wells who plays the waitress and aspiring singer who ends up having to do this humiliating striptease in Nashville, who I just think was incredible in that movie. And she was in Henry Jaglom's Eating, also incredible. So that maybe is a more, like, deep cut to steer you to. And I couldn't really, I couldn't like limit myself. So I had to, a couple of other great performances, Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona, that's a, would be under comedy. Samantha Morton in Code 46. Anything Samantha Morton does is wonderful, but I was incredibly moved by that. Nadine Nortier in Mouchette, the Robert Bresson film. I don't even know if that's a performance, but it's like it's a little bit like that woman in The New World or the girl in Whale Rider, just like a, just a face that just kind of haunts you throughout the movie. And Evan Rachel Wood in 13, I think, is one for the ages.
I know you love seeing the Gwen Wells reference there
Nashville. Yeah.
And Samantha Morton, she is very good in Code 46, yep. as in many things. And Holly Hunter, who I've already given some love to in my comedic performances. My honorable mentions, he had Barbara Stanwyck for The Lady Eve. I've got her on Dramatic for Double Indemnity. She's you can't take your eyes off her. I've also got Ellen Burstyn in Requiem for a Dream, Emily Watson in Breaking the Waves. And those two I considered for my top five, but I kind of went back to that idea of the pleasure of watching it. And,
right.
And while there is some pleasure in watching how good they are, they're both so devastating that it is hard for me as well. So I kind of had to throw them to the honorable mention.
No, it's great. I had Burstyn on there for Requiem Dream as well. Cloris Leachman in The Last Picture Show. Toni Collette in Sixth Sense, just because I love Toni Collette.
She's good.
She's remarkable in that. Anna Magnani in The Fugitive Kind. Alta Gracia Guzman, not a familiar name to probably anybody.
Bottle Rocket?
No. No, she wasn't the maid in Bottle
not
Rocket.
The maid.
No, she was the grandmother in Raising Victor Vargas, a favorite of mine.
Yes, it is.
Elizabeth Taylor in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And Sigourney Weaver in Aliens, another actress I needed to get on there. And I think with Aliens, yes, there's a pleasure in watching her, but it's a case of no one else. I can't imagine anyone else playing those parts in the Alien trilogy.
Okay, and so you mean the whole trilogy, or
I'm
is there one
the,
of those?
But particularly in Aliens, that's what I think of particularly. But Sigourney Weaver, a favorite actress of mine.
Okay, we are getting to the home stretch here,
yes,
Sam,
we
of this
are.
Marathon edition of Cinecast.
Wow.
We have now male dramatic performances.
Yeah,
we're going to start it off with Dylan Kidd, as we have been. Here it is.
Again, this totally blurs the line because this is one of my all-time favorite underrated movies. It's Alec Baldwin in Miami Blues. This is a demented movie, which I guess it's a comedy. I guess it's a drama. I don't know. This is, I mean, I think we've all sort of finally figured out that Alec Baldwin is a great character actor in a movie star's body. But this is an incredible performance in that it's both funny and terrifying at the same time. And yeah, I remember being really, it's like, there's something about this guy, he's so closed off, even the way he takes like a sip of beer off of a bottle, it's like he pops the bottle out, and it's like this guy is a closed circuit, and I just can't, he's completely compelling in this movie. I mean, if the definition of a great performance is somebody who, from the second you see him, you can't take your eyes off of him, This is that. Unbelievable.
Well, I do love seeing Alec Baldwin on any list, even though I'm not familiar with Miami Blues.
Pick. I own this film.
Do
this
you?
Is. I love how he describes, like, what is this film? A comedy? A drama? What? How are you? I remember watching this film not long ago, and it's a film I absolutely love because it's kind of just remarkable to watch. What you're watching Alec Baldwin do, you're just like, you're not sure if it's just it's completely over the top and distracting, or it's just like, or worthy of one of the greatest performances of all time designation. It is absolutely worth seeing. I mean, he and Jennifer Jason Leigh, but the performance itself, I mean, he doesn't get into what the film's about, but it is, it's really something.
Okay. Well, my number five is my real nostalgia choice on this list. If Dylan Kidd can go with Weird Science, this one probably has a little more credibility in that just Weird Science is such a, you know, this John Hughes 80s movie or whatever. It's kind of written off. But I've got Robin Williams in The World According to Garp. There was a time where I thought Robin Williams was a brilliant actor. And actually, I think he has that potential. I think his biggest problem is just making the right choices, obviously. But as an actor, this is another role that really walks that line between comedy and drama, but I love his performance in The World According to Garp as a writer, and having to deal with a mom as weird as Glenn Close's mom is in that movie. And there's something about what he really captures too later, and you see it more in the book, but really in the film, Robin Williams really captures that sense as a parent of wanting to protect your kids, and this kind of rage he almost goes into trying to make sure they're safe is really interesting. He's really a good actor, and it's unfortunate what has happened to him with some of his roles. So
that's a great pick. For me, my number five is, and I tried to distinguish between like what's a truly great performance or what is just pleasurable to watch because they're a badass. But I had to put Terrence Stamp in The Limey as Wilson in The Limey. This is just a film that gives me a great deal of pleasure. It's directed by Soderbergh, of course, but Terrence Stamp's performance in his like willingness to seem completely humorless almost, or like be, you know, for people's misunderstanding of him or their relationships with him are what's comic. It's not what he's doing necessarily that's comic. And of course, this is my dramatic list, but he's trying to find out what happened to his daughter. And the movie is, yes, it's funny, and but it's also very moving. And he's also just a complete badass. And I thought of somebody else that I considered for this list, Clive Owen and Croupier, another just like pleasurable experience watching. Yeah. But we'll have to wait for Clive Owen for another day.
We will have to wait on Clive Owen. And that takes us to number four.
Number four, James Woods and Salvador. Again, sort of a Usual Suspect, but I remember just being, and one of those things that you wonder, is he just sort of playing himself? I don't know. But I remember just being blown away by this movie when I saw it in high school. And just when you think that this guy's gone as grimy as he can get, he keeps going. And particularly his whole like rapport with Jim Belushi. Poor Jim Belushi. I mean, he gives a great performance. You know, where is he now? But this is their rapport, I think, is really great.
James Woods, obviously a brilliant actor, and that is definitely one of his most memorable roles. My number four, I'm going old school here. I knew this was going to happen. I suggested it might happen, Sam, with Scott Ferguson on his list. Maybe these roles need to age a little bit. Well, we'll see with my next four how that goes. He had Paul Newman on there for HUD. I've got him in Cool Hand Luke. And again, he is a character in that movie. We've talked about it a little bit before. The ultimate anti-hero, I think, and a guy who is a Christ figure. Obviously, he's the salvation for these people in this prison just because of his willingness or his lack of willingness to conform. And his ultimate charisma in that film is just what carries the entire movie. Yeah. He just has to be someone that people like so much and want to be around so much that they almost, they start to revere him like this Christ-like figure, right, that they can't live without him. And Paul Newman, you could put on a number of roles, but this is the one.
Your number one actor, and I knew it had to be on there.
Yeah. Has to.
It's a great pick. Okay, well, my number four, you put him on your top four comedic male performances, Campbell Scott and Roger Dodger, but I've got him here on the dramatic, and yes, his performance is very witty, but it's also, here's somebody that's absolutely at the very bottom, psychologically, certainly, and I think that you definitely see that. And I was actually, had the pleasure, really, of just having a conversation with Dylan Kidd about this performance, because it's obviously a performance that gives us a great deal of pleasure, and I was like, what was it like to watch Campbell Scott give this performance? I mean, as you're directing it. And he said something really interesting, an interesting insight into the film itself. The first scene that they filmed in Roger Dodger was the scene where he just dismantles that woman at the bar. Uh-huh. The first scene they filmed.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Look at the time. Let's do the math together.
What are you talking about?
Let me guess. Low self-esteem and premenopausal concern led you to pursue a series of semi-abusive relationships, but a recent dose of therapy has convinced you that inner beauty is what really matters, and you really deserve that perfect partner who treats you with such respect.
And Dylan said, actually, he was like, oh, that's how you're going to play it. He actually imagined the character being played a little more maniacally. And then he watched, you know, Campbell Scott deliver a performance that was just calm and menacing and brutal and cruel, and obviously set a tone for the rest of the film. But it was just really interesting to imagine that Dylan imagined that role differently, because you can't actually imagine it being played any other way than how Campbell Scott plays it.
There's something about the deliberation. He's so deliberate that it actually, what makes it, this just occurred to me as you were talking, I think what makes it so devastating, what he says to these people, is because he does it in a way that isn't maniacal. You almost think he's saying something nice to you.
Right. That he cares, like he cares enough to observe something about you.
Exactly. Yeah. And yet then the words come out and you realize what he's actually saying to you.
He gave me, 8 hours to learn about your father.
I mean, incredible. Okay, we've got here, we're to number three on Dylan Kidd's list. And I have to say, a choice I was kind of surprised with. Here it is.
This next number three, again, is sort of like a Usual Suspect, but Denzel Washington, Training Day, is a great, you know, he's one of those guys that no matter what he's doing, I'm always interested in watching him. But I think that there's something really, if you look at the script of Training Day, this is a real challenge to maintain this sense of, like, is this guy really on the level? And by the end, when you realize that he isn't, it's completely obvious throughout the whole movie, this guy's obviously bad news. But there's something about, so it takes a real special actor to maintain that ambiguity all the way through. And it's just, whatever, it's a bit of a scenery chewer, but it's just, I mean, he's our greatest actor, and this is, so far, his greatest performance, I think.
Yeah, our greatest actor. Dylan says. I don't know if you heard him say that, but he describes Denzel Washington as our greatest actor.
He's very good.
He's very good, but in Training Day as Alonzo. And it's just, I like how he describes it. It's the kind of description of a character that makes me want to go back and look at it again. In terms of the way he describes Denzel Washington's ability to capture the ambiguity
right.
of that character. Yeah. And it's true.
And I mean, I'm not surprised because it's not a great performance. I think it is, and yeah. I do the film as well, but just such a recent film, maybe yeah. seeing it that high on his list was interesting. And that brings us to our number three. Sam, what did you have?
My number three, I didn't know if I qualified. Did my penalty box still qualify?
The penalty box are
right,
gone.
Are out of the window. So I had to put Jack Nicholson, Randall Patrick McMurphy from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in this film. I mean, it really is. Nicholson obviously has a natural charisma that he employs in all of his films, and he's always interesting to watch. But in this case, where the stakes are raised so high, and it's just like he's contained, you know, and that his charisma is actually his enemy in some sense, you know, with his battle with Nurse Ratched. I mean, it's just like he's given countless great performances, as Scott Ferguson
sure.
mentioned. Like he couldn't limit it. I mean, you list those five films that Scott mentioned back to back, you're just like, what an extraordinary
right.
resume that is.
The
but
four,
if
yeah.
I was going to pick one, it's going to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, and wouldn't you know it, it's exactly the one I picked.
At number three.
Yeah, R.P. McMurphy, Jack Nicholson is my number three as well. I'm not going to add anything. It's Nicholson. It's a Pantheon performance, and it's a Pantheon film, and it belongs on the list. So we're then at the number two choice.
Number two, David Thewlis in Naked. This movie was a big inspiration for me because it sort of taught me that a character doesn't have to be likable. It's more just it just as long as you're interested, character can spew whatever nonsense he wants to see. And so there's a lot of David Thewlis's character found its way into Roger Dodger in a way, just like this idea. Well, you can hang a movie on one guy and one night going kind of bonkers as long as you get a really special performance. And I like performances where there's no part of the character that's asking you to like him. It would be very easy for this kind of guy to sort of somehow, you know, wink to the audience or sort of say, I know I'm terrible, but I was molested as a child or whatever the thing is going to be. And David Thewlis is just, it's like acts like no one's watching, which is like the definition of a great performance.
Yeah, it's a performance. David Thewlis, I mean, when I saw this film years and years ago, and it's probably one I would have considered, in fact, was considering, but you know, I'm giving it to Dylan. It's all his. But it's one of these, like, I went to see films that David Thewlis is in based strictly on seeing Naked, I think back in 95 or something like that. Went to see, what's that terrible film that Marlon Brando was in about
the island of
Dr. Moreau, which was, I think, maybe one of the first films he did after, you know, just completely and utterly wasted, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I mean, again, has he been in anything? Has he been given a role that's remotely as sort of epic as this performance?
And what's amazing, too, is hearing him talk about the relationship
yes.
to Roger Dodger,
absolutely.
The inspiration.
You can totally
and you
see
can
it.
See it.
Oh, my
you
God.
You totally
yeah.
see how
yeah.
he's a character who is so fascinating to listen to
yeah.
and the way he just cuts through everything and says exactly what's on his mind and is so articulate,
wow.
even though he's so hateful in,
yeah.
in many ways and really a bad character. It is a brilliant performance. My number two, again, I'm with Scott Ferguson in these Pantheon performances.
Yeah.
You had to know De Niro was going to make my list. He had De Niro for Raging Bull. I've got De Niro for Raging Bull. I just think there are certain performances that, you know, when I'm sitting my son Holden down in 5 years and saying, you're going to get into movies, because I'm going to force you to, you're into movies, you have to see these performances. You got to see Paul Newman in Cool Hand Luke.
Right.
You got to see Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over, and you have to see De Niro in Raging Bull. Beyond obviously just putting on all the weight and the kind of virtuosity he shows there, the bottom line is he makes a character again who is very hateful and easy to dislike. He makes you actually see what he's going through and empathize with him, when in many ways he's kind of a monster, Jake LaMotta is. And obviously De Niro, you could pick a number of roles that he has played, but Raging Bull is the one that will always be my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, and I look at my list, and the fact that Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, or Marlon Brando does not appear on my top five list is a little shocking,
yeah.
But I think I always went back to this sense of, like, the pleasure principle, if you will.
Yes, Janet Jackson.
To quote Janet Jackson. And for me, it's like, there are a number of great performances, and they even give me some pleasure, but Raging Bull is like a kind of a punishing experience to watch. And
uh-huh.
yes, it's just amazing to watch De Niro transform and become Jake LaMotta. But my number two, instead, I'm giving to John Wayne as John T. Chance in Rio Bravo. Because really, I mean, there is just something. I love the authority that John Wayne has in this film. And I think he's the definition of a personality. Yes, like on screen. And like that's truly what makes films so exciting to watch is when we see just great personalities people that would be larger than life in life be larger than life on screen. And John Wayne is just one of these just once in a generation performers, and it is a performance. And my favorite so far. I can't wait to dip into the John Wayne archives.
Right, we have many films to
see if
to
anything
get through.
Matches, but. I mean, it's just a phenomenal.
We've definitely
thing to
sung the praises, literally. Yeah. I think maybe of
I
Rio
think we
Bravo.
Have we sung it
on
yeah.
the show? So, well, here we are. We have arrived at our number one, Dylan Kidd. Great choice. Not a big surprise, though. Here it is.
And then this is the all-time obvious thing, but Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver is my all-time favorite dramatic performance. Enough said. I mean, come on. As much as we sort of know Robert De Niro now, and he has a sort of public persona, still, when you watch that movie, you don't see Robert De Niro. You see Travis Bickle. And, to me, one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema is the scene where he tries to tell Peter Boyle how he's feeling. And it's just like the ultimate expression of like males unable to emotionally connect. It's just a great scene. He's like, I think I really am going to do something. And like Peter Boyle gives this whole speech. Sometimes a man, he wants to, and they don't connect at all. And it's just brilliant. So... no surprises there, but that I gotta say that was that performance has been in a way like Robert De Niro takes on all the male rage for all of us in that movie, and that movie is like cathartic in the true sense of the word. So none of us have to go out and wild people in the street. We can just watch that movie and experience it vicariously.
And of course, he admits not a surprise. And it's funny how he was so reluctant to make obvious picks.
Another cinecast correlation. He constantly throughout this whole process, you've heard him say
obvious,
it's a cliche, just like we always do. It's so perfect.
And, but you do sometimes. It's like it's a favorite performance. You don't want to deny it. It belongs there. And De Niro, of course, in Taxi Driver, belongs there. And it's how you describe a great performance. Mm-hmm. You can't see the actor beneath the performance.
Yeah, he's dead on. And Sam, I'm dying to know your number one.
This shouldn't be a surprise. Really? Either.
Okay,
really?
Let's hear
so
it.
You're not anticipating it necessarily.
Right now, I don't know what it is, but at this point in the night, my brain is kind of melted. So let's go ahead and get to your number one.
It's Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher, of course, in Gangs of New York. And it's a relatively recent performance, but I think I compare every performance now to Daniel Day-Lewis's performance, and it is a truly theatrical performance. I mean, we talked about Emma Thompson. Like, here's in her performance, in The Tall Guy, here's a brilliant actress performing a role. In many cases you see somebody, you don't see actors so often performing. And certainly that's what you have Daniel Day-Lewis doing. It's absolutely menacing and punishing, and he's intimidating, but he's truly, truly theatrical. And it's a rare, pleasurable experience to have, to watch somebody fill a screen with gesture and size and really having fun with the language, just chewing the scenery up and really having the talent to fulfill that kind of role.
Yeah, no, it was such a tough omission for me. We've talked about it. He was on our villains list, probably our badass list. I mean, we love Daniel Day-Lewis in this role. He's the best thing about the film.
Yeah.
I think
we would
both agree with that. And I think it goes back to something I said about Don Cheadle in Devil in the Blue Dress. He's like Mouse in that he's a character who you just don't know what he's capable of, but you know he's capable of a lot. Like at any moment, he's just going to snap and you don't know when it's going to come, but you're afraid of him.
Yeah.
And I think it is a brilliant performance. So I'm not surprised that it's your number one, but my number one is exactly the opposite of Daniel Day-Lewis. It's about as far as you can get from that theatrical performance that he gives. You can't get more inward, introspective, and psychological and subtle than Al Pacino in The Godfather 1 and 2. Again, the Pantheon's out the window. I'm sorry, no penalty box here. Everything's up for grabs in this show, our 100th episode. And the bottom line is, again, back to the pleasure principle. As dramatic a movie as that is, and how heavy The Godfather 1 and 2 can be at certain times, literally nothing excites me more than flipping channels and seeing The Godfather come on, even though I've seen it a million times, and just watching Al Pacino's performance. And I love De Niro, too, as the young Don in The Godfather 2. That's fun to watch as well. But watching Pacino's transformation, I literally just love watching every moment that Pacino has in that movie. Every facial reaction, every word, the deliberation with which he speaks, every word. And again, watching the transformation, not only from one to two, but even just in one of embracing the dark side, so to speak, going from a fresh-faced kid to someone who's just absolutely ruthless.
Well,
and with such subtlety. Nothing gives me more pleasure. That's the bottom line, the watching Pacino and The Godfather.
I think I was keeping the Pantheon in mind, or the penalty box in mind, because I didn't put him on here. Because really, one of my favorite scenes in movies, absolutely, is the conversation he and Brando have when they're passing out. I mean, it's just like, I mean...
In which part exactly?
Just when he tells Michael...
I'm with you and...
Well, and he's just like, oh, I already told you that. That's right.
Yeah,
enough. I
okay.
mean, it's just
in
like,
the garden. That's
in the garden.
Before he dies, I believe,
exactly.
Right? Yeah, and for me, in Godfather 2, the single moment, nothing more devastating
I'm getting chills right now. You're just
Diane
about
to say Keaton it. Coming to the door to get the kids, and him just shutting the door on her. I love it.
Well, I thought you were going to say too. Like, I knew it was you, Fred. I mean, that I just because I thought you were going to describe that, and it's you get a visceral response just thinking about
it. It's beautiful
that
too. You're right. It is. Okay. Well, we're here at our honorable mentions. Yeah. Then let's go ahead. We got a decent list here from Dylan. Here they are.
Some other great performances for me: Harvey Keitel in Bad Lieutenant. It's another scenery chewer. Brad Davis in Midnight Express. When I was in high school, that was a big movie for me. Burt Lancaster in Sweet Smell of Success. John Leguizamo in Summer of Sam, I love. When I was a kid, and then like the two performances that I don't even know if they hold up, but like the 12-year-old in me will always just love is Rucker Hauer and Blade Runner and Mickey Rourke and Rumblefish. Just two beautiful people do it, just vamping, but like vamping beautifully. You know, I love in Rumblefish how Mickey Rourke never speaks above a whisper and just forces you to kind of lean forward, and it's just great.
And of course, I meant decently sized. Of course, the list is very good. I love the Rutger Hauer inclusion there. You recently mentioned Bad Lieutenant on the show. Brad Davis, Midnight Express, is a great role as well. Unfortunately, we didn't see much more out of Brad Davis, kind of a tragic character in his own right. My honorable mentions, I've got Daniel Day-Lewis, of course, Gangs of New York, Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, and Kenneth Branagh in Henry V.
I can basically attribute
the fact that I went from being someone who thought he was actually going to major in business and then never took a business course in college to being an English major completely because of Kenneth Branagh's performance in Henry V.
Wow. Where he brought Shakespeare to your door.
He did.
I think I'm giving credit to a lot of supporting performances in here, although there are some lead performances in here too that I really love. Dylan Baker and Philip Seymour Hoffman, but Dylan Baker particularly.
Happiness?
In Happiness. One of the most remarkable performances of all time.
Maybe.
Sidney Pollack in Husbands and Wives. I think he's incredible. James Nesbitt in Bloody Sunday. Richard Farnsworth in The Straight Story. Al Pacino and Russell Crowe in The Insider. Benicio del Toro in Traffic at 21 Grams. Jeffrey Wright in Shaft.
That's
amazing.
Right. You love him.
Love
as,
it.
As Peoples, right?
And I couldn't finish Cinecast, our last breaths as Cinecast, without mentioning again Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life.
You had to do it, didn't you? And now, as Film Spotting, you can never mention
Jimmy Stewart. He's in the permanent penalty box.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm breathing now. That is our show.
Uh-huh.
That is Cinecast. Thanks to Aberdeen City, Scott Ferguson, Dylan Kidd, Sarah Kempinar, Carrie Van Deest,
Hallgren.
Future varied Carrie Van
we
Deest.
We have to
Hallgren.
Thank our wives and future wives at this point for really putting up with us and putting up with the time we've devoted to Cinecast, including even recording a marathon
show
like
this.
Yeah. Really, they've been so incredible, and we couldn't do it without them.
And we promised them we'd only do 100 episodes, so that's it.
Yeah, that's it. We're done.
We have to renegotiate that contract.
I know. We're going to have to. But again, we do really have to thank Aberdeen City. It was great seeing them the other night. And again, you can download a couple of the songs you heard, the acoustic songs, exclusively on cinecastshow.com. Click on the music page. Scott Ferguson was great. It's wonderful to get emails from guys like that. We're going to hopefully have him on the show again. He recently watched a screening of All the King's Men, a movie he worked on, a movie we're dying to see.
Coming out this fall, can't wait to see.
Hopefully we can have him on. He worked on the film. We'll have him on to talk about it. But he's genuinely a fan of the show, which
just
again
incredible.
Tells us that, wow, I guess we are doing something that people are into here when a guy like Scott can enjoy the show. And then Dylan Kidd. The treat to have, really, in a way, one of our idols. I mean, that's how much we love the movie Roger Dodger. He couldn't have been better.
All right. Well, please send any feedback to this show to cinecast@cinecastshow.com or give us a call at 206-203-CINE. That's 206-203-2463. And leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at cinecastshow.com. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Cinecast. And go to iTunes as well. Put your votes there.
Yeah, leave a comment.
Also on our blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Cinecast weekly email blast.
And you know, Sam, one group that we left out of the roster of thank yous, of course, the Cinecast listeners. The show would be nothing without the audience we have. Literally, we have segments devoted to listener feedback because it's that good, and we have to leave out so many good emails and comments from you every week. And the reason we are as disciplined as we are, hopefully, in getting these shows up and putting as much effort we do is because we know you appreciate it. And thank you to everyone who's been listening. Thank you to everyone who's been with us since show number one or joined later and has gone back and listened to all the episodes. That always blows us away. People go back and start at number one and catch up, and it's really been amazing to have the interaction we've had and even meet some of you. Yeah. It's been incredible so far.
It really is, because what it is, it's a conversation between Adam and I, yes, but it's a conversation also between us and all of you.
And
so
if it was just the two of us without the listeners being a part of it, it would not be nearly as much fun. That's all there is to it. Next week, Cinecast celebrates its own 100th episode milestone with a brief siesta. The show will return, though, as we said, under our new name, Film Spotting, on Tuesday, May 23rd with guest host Scott Smith. Scott and I will review The Da Vinci Code and share our top five religious movies. Thanks again to Aberdeen City for today's music, and we mentioned tour dates coming up. They're with Sound Team and Elephant right now. Toronto tonight on Friday, May 12th, then Montreal, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, Boston, D.C., Louisville, Dallas, and Austin. Check them out at aberdeenmusic.com for more information.
Yeah, and if you're going to go, get there early. They are opening the set there, mm-hmm. you know, so they play the first half hour, 40 minutes of music, and they're absolutely worth seeing. They're fantastic.
It was an incredible set of music. It really was. For Cinecast, and it does sadden me to say that for the last time, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And for Cinecast, I'm Sam Hallgren. Thanks so much for listening.
Cinecast is presented by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you have for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/cinecast. And also by Honda Fit. The all-new Honda Fit is small on the outside, yet roomy and versatile on the inside. A VTEC engine, anti-lock braking system, and front side and side curtain airbags are standard. And for added style, there's the Fit Sport Automatic with rear roofline spoiler and wheel-mounted paddle shifters. The Honda Fit is set and ready to go. Check it out at fit.honda.com.